wherever you may be, and welcome to Observations. Today is going to be the start of a series of shows that we're going to do on wrestling these myths of conspiracies to the ground. But Kirk, I'd like to begin with a bit of good-natured gloating.
Okay. Go for it. You deserve it.
Do you ever? I'm not sure I deserve it. But hey, do you remember what I said about Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, adds to the basis of the Swedish probe into him allegedly raping a woman?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay. I had said that the claims against Assange, who is, you know, along with Eric Snowden, probably the most valuable person on the planet today in terms of providing credible information. Important information that, in fact, you did a number of shows just on the information that was released from the U.S. State Department, how the CIA in particular was actively involved in Syria, trying to create the very war and the conflict between groups like the Islamic State and the Syrian government. They actually had a plan, and they perpetrated the plan, and the Syrian war is a direct result of the American plan.
Right
from the horse's mouth, part of the WikiLeaks disclosures. Well, I came to the conclusion that the reason that Julian Assange is having to be holed up in the embassy in London, based upon charges that he allegedly raped a woman in Sweden, was because the United States wanted to censure him. The United States wanted to have at him and to silence him because just like the Democratic releases pertinent to the DNC emails that the Russians allegedly confiscated and then published, you know, you ought not be mad at the Russians. You ought to be mad at yourself for saying things that are so daggone incriminating. And the same thing was true here with Julian Assange. I viewed that that the U.S. government shouldn't try to seek him out and blame him for anything, that they instead should be looking in the mirror and say, boy, we've really said and done some stupid stuff. We should stop doing that stupid stuff.
Yes.
And so the whole idea with the sexual scandal in Sweden was trumped up charges just for the express purposes of being able to censure the man. It was announced today that all charges against Julian Assange in Sweden for allegedly raping a woman have been dropped. Now, the British, being good lapdogs now of the United States, said, well, we're still not going to release him. If he comes out, we're going to arrest him because he jumped bail. Well, he only jumped bail because that was falsely accused. And you're not smart enough in Britain to figure that out?
Apparently not.
So, anyway, just a moment of gloating. I've got one other thing I want to gloat about, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Sometimes when you analyze news and you come to conclusions that no one else is saying, and then future reporting demonstrates that your analysis and conclusions were right, those were fairly profound statements years ago when this happened.
Controversial at the time.
If you don't bring it up, that, you know, I told you this was going to happen, folks, then I think you're wasting an opportunity to enhance one's credibility.
You know, Yahweh would never waste that opportunity either.
He does not waste that, yes.
Hard copy.
Yes, right. He doesn't waste that opportunity either. I had said that I thought that Trump had a real issue with his problems in Russia. And that that there was something deeply disturbing about what was going on there. Well, two things have surfaced.
Mm-hmm.
One is he fired the head of the FBI, Comey, because Comey wouldn't swear a loyalty oath to him. Where in the Constitution is somebody asked to swear a loyalty oath to an individual?
I think it was designed for balance of power, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness. No. Listen, I'm not going to run for office because I'm not going to swear an oath to the Constitution.
No.
But that's the only thing that you're supposed to swear an oath to. Now, Trump says in one moment that he didn't fire him for that, and in the next moment that he didn't fire him for the probe on Russia, and then in another moment that he did fire him for that reason. It is apparent that the ultimate reason that Trump fired him was because he would not brief the White House on what he was going to report to Congress regarding the probe into Russia, and that the most frequent request that Trump had of Comey was, please affirm that I'm not part of your investigation on Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I myself, I'm not part of that investigation, am I? I think that the FBI just released that there were, I don't know if it's 18 or 21 known contacts now between the Trump campaign and the Russians in the 6 months prior to the general election. He's got a serious problem here.
You ain't kidding.
He's got a serious problem here. And what he did with Comey is likely a criminal act that could lead to impeachment, because you can't impede the federal government. Yeah, you can't impede the federal government in the midst of an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, just both of those two things I thought were interesting. I'm going to say one more thing.
Okay.
I had said that the Trump, while he said all nice things about Israel and critical things about this formation of a state for the mythical Palestinians, was going back on everything that he had said. Do you know what Trump's last business deal between the United States and a foreign country comprised of?
No.
I'm going to give you a hint. The amount of the transaction in its first phase is $100 billion, and it's going to grow to $300 billion.
That's a big number. Tell me.
Do you know who it's with?
Palestinians?
No. Oh, gosh, No. Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. Well, that's
okay. So what did Trump agree to sell? What was the item?
Arms.
Weapons. Weapons. 100 to 300.
What else would they want?
A aircraft carrier, which is the most expensive thing one can build or have in one's military. I don't know, $3 to $5 billion. We're talking about $100 to $300 billion.
Now that's whose money?
Well, they're going to buy these war materials, but yeah. Saudi Arabia.
So what do you think they're going to use that material for? That war material?
You know, Saudi Arabia only has one irritating foe and one stated foe.
Mm-hmm.
Their irritating foe is they don't like the Shias in Iran.
Correct.
But if they were to use American weapons in a war against the Shia in Iran, guess who's on the other side of that war?
Well, that's Russia on the other side.
And Russia and China.
And China.
Yeah, Russia and China. So I'd put the United States against Russia and China. That would be really swell, wouldn't it?
Well, we're overcome by our stupidness so often. So.
Yeah. And then the only stated enemy of Saudi Arabia is Israel.
Yes, Israel.
So if you want, if you wanted America to be in the crosshairs of Yahweh's wrath,
mm-hmm.
who would you sell weapons to, and how much would you sell of them?
Well, if you want to be in the wrath,
Yahweh's wrath,
that would be you've already
$100 billion worth of weapons to the Saudi Arabians. Yeah. That would get it done. All right, I'm going to begin by just getting a review of things over the past 15 years, Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
I've written in the Company of Good and Evil about my experience in business.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it is so much of that book is going to pertain to what we're going to be talking about throughout today.
Okay.
Then Tea with Terrorists, about my meeting with Al-Qaeda and other Islamic terrorist groups. Prophet of Doom, which is the most comprehensive, most chronological and contextual presentation of the Islamic scriptures. The Islamic terrorist timeline, the clubs of jihad, 7 volumes of Yada Yah, questioning Paul, 5 volumes of An Introduction to God, and Observations for Our Time.
Right.
It is a total of 20 books and 10,000 pages of personal experience, research, translations, insights, observations, and commentary. All of it's available free. Most of what is contained in these books is unique, life-changing, revealing profound and seldom, if ever, understood insights for the very first time. And over that period, I've asked very little of the reader in return for being given access to my research, translations, and insights. These restrictions include, and I'm going to go through them, there's 5 of them.
Absolutely.
And I think if you provided 20 books and 10,000 pages of personal experience and research and translations mm-hmm. and observations, much of the material unavailable anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
That you're giving away free. You're entitled to a few restrictions.
Sure.
1. Do not misrepresent what I've written. If you're going to quote me accurately.
Mm-hmm.
2. Do not take what I have written out of context.
Yes, okay. Right.
Number 3. Do not cite what I've written unless you have verified it for yourself and have come to understand what I've conveyed. Now, why that's important is the last thing I want is somebody going off and said and making some claim about, say, for example, Muhammad without having a clue as to why he said it, the context he said it, and without the ability to back it up.
Yeah.
And they're going to make a mess of things. Don't go off half-cocked. Don't quote somebody unless you have taken the time to read the entire story and you've come to understand how the pieces fit together before you cite a piece of it.
Well, you said that for the 10 years that I've known you. I think it's excellent advice.
Yeah, every bit of 10 years I have made that claim. Next. Never use anything I have written under any circumstance to justify violence of any kind.
Right.
Use words, not weapons. You know, I have a lot of critical things to say about Muhammad and Islam, a lot of critical things to say about Paul and Christianity.
Indeed.
And I want to make it absolutely, unequivocally certain that everybody who uses, reads my material never uses it under any circumstances as a pretext for violence.
Well, you know, you emphasize that initially, or at least one of the times I remember when you were talking about the Ku Klux Klan and how it was destroyed by words. And I thought that was the best example of modern history where we've actually done the right thing.
Right. Correct. Correct. And so those four statements I have stated, I've been doing this now for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been consistent for 15 years making those statements. I've got a 5th one that I added several years ago. Do not cite anything I've written in conjunction with a conspiracy theory or fake news. Now, the reason I started making that statement about 5 years ago was that I was at one time, I would say I was a conspiracy theorist. I was interested in seeing if a grand unification of conspiracies could be constructed. Mm-hmm. What happened, Kirk, is that I was translating 2 Peter, 2nd chapter. And there is a Greek word in there that would be translated conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the time, I did not realize that Peter did speak Greek, didn't write anything in Greek, that his name wasn't even Peter, and that we don't have a copy of what he wrote within that dates to within even 300 years of the time that he wrote it. And so all we have is manuscripts that were heavily edited by the Roman Catholic Church. And so I would never, ever now extrapolate anything from a Greek word in a letter that we don't even know if Shimon Kephish, the real name of the person called Peter. We don't even know if he wrote it, and we don't have any old documents of it, and we know for certain he didn't write it
in Greek,
and we don't have a Hebrew copy. So I would never, never now even bother to write anything on it, much less make any kind of a deal about conspiracy. But at the time, I just didn't know. It's, you know, I probably wrote that 15 years ago. Learned a lot in 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And but having read it, I said, you know, wouldn't it be interesting? Because I had read Hyslop's book. Are you familiar with Hyslop's book, The Two Babylons?
Vaguely.
All right. Hyslop wrote a book that compared the Roman Catholic Church with the Babylonian religion. And he found, well, it's probably a 300-page book, a ton of similarities. The problem is that most of the resources that he cited went out of press centuries ago, and that the library that he used no longer exists. And so it's hard to verify his claims.
Yeah, it's hard to go back.
And the biggest issue was, if you read the book, which, you know, I think it's an interesting read. If you read the book, what you find is that there is vastly more confusion than there is a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if in fact you could go with the Trinity and show how the Trinity was the same cast of characters in the Babylonian religion as it was in the Egyptian religion, as it was in the Greek religion, as it was in the Babylonian religion, and that the cast of characters comprising the pagan Trinity was a perfect match for the cast of characters in the Christian Trinity, then that would be an interesting case to make.
All right.
But they differ. The characteristics of each of the players differ. I mean, for example, it started off that the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God was Astarte. She became known as Semiramis and has a host of other names, including Ishtar, the basis for Easter. You know, and then as you go from Babylon, different names entirely in Assyria. And then it's not just Isis and Osiris in Egypt. Ra isn't the father figure during that time. It's just the other two are the mother and son.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got issues there. And then you go into the Greek religion and why Dionysus is the most likely candidate for the son, and Athena the mother, and Zeus the father. There are... The Greek mythology is not only inconsistent, but there are lots of sexual encounters between the gods.
Right.
Not just that one. And there are lots of the things that tie the gratia, the graces, with which were the charities with Dionysus.
Well, there's a profound twist
with Dionysus.
Whatever's in there.
So it, what it becomes when you try to track these things down, and when you try to look at the history of Easter, for example, there isn't a clean swath from the Babylonian practice of Easter to the Christian practice of Easter. It's subtle and it's woven in between, but there's more confusion than there is a straight line continuum. And I found that not only was that true, because I wanted to have a grand unification theory, if you will, of conspiracy, of how the Babylonian religion became the wellspring that ultimately was incorporated into Roman Catholicism and then into Christianity in general. And while you find lots of connections, there is not... The reason that Hyslop's book is so difficult to read and so confusing is because the whole trail is confused, and it's designed It's designed to be confusing. What does Babel mean, which is the basis of
confusion.
Babylon? Confusion. Now, I heard the same thing with this path to what I would once refer to as the New World Order. I don't use that term anymore, but that was the term that I used at the time. And so the originator, by almost all accounts, would be Adam Weishaupt and his Order of the Enlightened. And so there's some really interesting texts. Memoirs and History of Jacobinism is probably the most comprehensive. It was written by Abe Verrill, who was a Roman Catholic priest, because he recognized that the whole purpose of the Order of the Illumes was to have enlightened secular men replace the authority of Roman Catholicism. Yeah, that was all they wanted to do. They wanted to replace the influence of Roman Catholicism in European governments, because there was this interconnection between the religion and, you know, cleric and king, if you will, particularly Roman Catholic clergy and the kings and queens of Europe. And they wanted to replace that with secular leaders who were enlightened. And so I became an expert on Adam Weishaupt.
Mm-hmm.
And I read all of the original material that can be traced back to him. And then I began to study the interweavings of what he wrote and the history of Freemasonry and his influence in Freemasonry, and read Pike's Morals and Dogma. And I even got Quigley's book, which is, you know, where somebody claims to be part of the New World Order, saying, yeah, it's all true. And you try, and I want to add Quigley's book, you say, that's a tough read, man. That's tough sledding. And I read a number of books, you know, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, The Unseen Hand by Epperson, which I think is a really good book, economically, anyway. And probably read 50 books. Like Sutton is one of those that is really popular in that genre. Best Enemy Money Can Buy, I think, is probably one of his best, about how America financed Russian companies and actually built Russian companies to provide the weapons that were used against Americans in Vietnam
during the war.
Yeah. Yeah. So I read it all. I spent a year studying it. And I came to the conclusion that the connections between what Adam Weishaupt did and his influence over seminaries and academic institutions and politics and political correctness and the like, that connection was as murky and as confused as the one that I tried to tie together for religion, to have a grand unification theory. You know, I thought if you could do that in an intelligent way, it'd be a great service for humankind.
Mm-hmm.
And after a year's time, and man, I went to the sources on all of this. In fact, I even read on the Babylonian religious side, there are a number of softback, very large, I mean, they're textbook size things, books, that are translations of the oldest clay tablets from Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Detailing the nature of the religion. And the characters, their attributes and their names even change within eras of each country's adaptation and application of that religion.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is, it can't be done. It was an absolute and utter waste of time. And so the single most prevalent conspiracy, which is this migration, politically anyway, from Adam Weishaupt and the Order of the Illumes, called the Illuminati by some, to the New World Order. It just can't be made.
No.
And not only can it be credibly made, even if you were to try, it would be such a convoluted story. You'd have to, your explanation would only appeal to people with the highest possible intellect, because it'd be so difficult to continue to marshal these connections forward. It was just a waste of time. And there was nothing to be gained by it.
Well, yeah, I mean, what do you do then? What do you do with information?
Right, there was nothing to gain by the connections.
Talk about it,
could not credibly, yeah, they could not credibly be made. There's no way to tie, for example, the Council on Foreign Relations to it, or the De Bilderbergers, Couldn't be done. Bilderbergers. Couldn't be done. It just, I mean, people can talk about it and they can have fun with it all they want, and there's you know, nuances here and there, and and sometimes it's fun to speculate, particularly on this one. And the only reason I think that this one is interesting to talk about, both of the, these two are interesting to talk about, is because Yahweh's overt animosity to religion and politics, and because he foretells of a one world government, essentially. During the last 3.5 years.
Yes.
And so, you know, I thought...
Right.
So, I thought if I went back in history and tried to tie that together, I could help explain exactly how what he predicted is going to unfold. And the same thing with religion. There's nothing that God hates more than religion, and he condemns it right at the beginning and the end by identifying religion with Babylon. So if I could show exactly how it all transpired, but it's impossible. And I think a lot of it is for two reasons. One is, with religion, the entire purpose of religion is to confuse.
Right.
So, if you're looking to explain religion and the progression of religion, the dissemination of religion, the evolution of religion from a rational point of view, it's impossible.
No.
It's impossible. So don't bother.
And a washing machine, isn't it?
Right. So, I mean, I've got no issue, and God's got no issue, of explaining why what certain people said and did is inaccurate. You know, I'm explaining why Paul's letter to the Galatians is invalid, making him a false prophet. It's not a conspiracy. It's just simply saying, this is what he wrote. This is why it's not true. You shouldn't trust him.
No.
And the same thing is true with politics. That case cannot be made.
Well, let me also interject here. The very thing that you and were agreed upon by IQ Arizoli was Islam being a criminal enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not a conspiracy. That's just a business.
That's all you have to do is read and understand the eighth surah. Read and understand the eighth surah in the context of Muhammad's world, and that conclusion is obvious.
Yeah.
Stating that conclusion from the evidence, that's not a conspiracy.
Yeah.
It's a statement of fact. Now, a prophet of doom, for example, it's not a conspiracy. No, it says, this is what Muhammad said in the context of how he said it, in the order that he said it, so that people with the Quran put it in the chronological order and in the context of Muhammad's life could actually understand the man and the religion. What's the purpose of it? There is no conspiracy there. Paul didn't conspire to create Christianity. He's not conspiring.
No. He ingratiated himself and tried to use those lies to promote himself.
And by the way, conspire, by the definition, requires more than one person.
Mm-hmm. To plot.
Yeah, to plot. And to scheme behind the scenes. Paul laid it all out. There were no secrets.
Yeah.
And by the way, what, no.
Yeah,
and a really conspiracy requires their plots to be a crime.
Yeah.
What he did was a crime spiritually, but nothing he did was a crime in society. As a matter of fact, he said, honor the Roman government. Do what they tell you to do. He even had the party line, the Roman government, tell you, you've got to do what we tell you to do because we have God's authority. He even agreed. He said, the Roman government, they've got God's authority.
Yeah.
Submit to them.
Well, conspire also means to agree by oath, which means you'd have to have more than one person involved in it, and he doesn't do that. He just, he does his thing.
Yeah. Now, I want to continue here.
Sure.
Over the past 15 years, I've spoken on some 2,500 radio shows. As an expert on Islamic terrorism, compiling over 3,000 hours of interviews. On 2,000 of my own shows, either as part of Yada Yada Radio, Shattering Myths, or more recently this show, Observations, we have compiled 4,000 hours of audio insights and commentary. Now, as a result, it could be reasonably argued that I've made a significant investment and that I've asked very little in return. It might also be reasonable to conclude that I've earned the right to defend my translations, my revelations, and insights from being misappropriated and misused.
Agreed.
Now, there is a person and as part of, and we're going to be speaking of this throughout today and on future observation shows, as well as on the IDI radio tonight, about a really despicable group called Unpopular Truth. There is one person there that continues to post. He has no right to tell me that I can't use his translations. They're Yahweh's words. They don't belong to him. I have every right to use them. For him to tell me that I can't use them in conjunction with conspiracy theories is like a cult leader. Are you familiar with any aspect of copyright law?
Quite a lot.
Okay, because you're an artist, right?
Definitely.
You're an artist, okay. Well, copyright law on a translation, for example, the oldest Greek manuscripts of the Christian New Testament and the Masoretic text of the Hebrew, it's not copyrighted. That's not copyrighted. The New Living Translation, the New International Version, the New King James, the New American Standard Bible translations, they are all copyrighted.
Yes.
Yahweh's words, as he conveyed them in Hebrew, are not copyrighted. My translations of his words
yes.
are mine. They are mine.
Mm-hmm.
They are my property.
Intellectual.
I give you the right to read them for free, the right to use them for free, but with those five caveats. And I have every right to make those five requests that you do not use them in a way that incorrectly quotes what I've written, that you don't take what I've written out of context, that you do not use what I've written to commit an or justify an act of violence, that you do not use them in conjunction with conspiracy theories. Now, one of the conclusions, I didn't share this with you, and I should have, Kirk.
Okay.
The number one conclusion that I came to after realizing that pursuing conspiracies was not only a waste of time is that it's counterproductive. Now, wasting time, by the way, is counterproductive. We only have so much time. There's a lot to learn, a lot to know, a lot to understand, a lot to share. And so doing something that cannot be achieved is clearly a waste of time, and therefore that's not productive. It's therefore counterproductive. But the reason I say that pursuing conspiracies, and I was pursuing the two biggest conspiracies in the history of the world, the integration of religion within society and how it migrated from one culture to another, and the impetus behind what's called the New World Order from Adam Weishaupt to the present. The reason it's counterproductive is not just because it's a waste of time. And that's the thing that so many people are focusing. I don't want to waste my time on this. You know, too much else to do. No, it's a waste of time because it is the ultimate destroyer of credibility. When we pursue the most popular conspiracies today, and we're going to talk about some of those, like the collapse of the World Trade Center, Building 7 in particular, chemtrails versus condensation trails. When you pursue things that are so easily provable to be the opposite of what you're saying, that what you're saying is so irrational that when you say it, when you promote it, the only people that you gain credibility with are those who have drunk the same poison that you have,
mm-hmm.
those that go to the same well that you do. You may gain credibility within the 5% fringe of society that has found meaning in these things because they can't find meaning anywhere else in their lives. And they've lost the ability to be rational. And with that group, they may applaud you, and you may just feel great when you're around that group, and you say that everybody else is wrong, and boy, we are the truthers. But with anybody in the 95% that hasn't been poisoned by them, you sound like a kook. Because guess what? You are. And so I don't want Yahweh's testimony in conjunction with someone, used in conjunction with someone who is promoting a conspiracy theory of any kind, particularly the most obnoxious ones that are being laid out today, and we're going to be talking about those. And the reason is, credibility is everything. And if somebody sees you talking about conspiracy in the midst of presenting Yahweh's words, his name, or the terminology, for example, that found only in the books that I've written, you're destroying our credibility. And while I wouldn't care about you destroying my credibility, I don't care about you destroying your own, you're destroying what may be the only complete and accurate witness of what Yahweh had to say.
Yeah, certainly to an English-speaking world, you can't get it anywhere else.
So that is why I am so concerned. Now, the most egregious violator of this request is a fellow named Larry Hendricks. I don't think that's his real name. I think his name is Jack Brower, or it's one or the other. Who knows what his real name is, whether it's Jack Brower or Larry Hendricks. But he certainly on his unpopular truth site, and as he was a participant in our shows, he went under the name of Larry Hendricks. His Facebook page has become a cesspool of conspiracy. And unfortunately, he garners attention and draws people in using my translations and terminology. Now, what follows is an analysis of, I'm going to share with you in a moment, some correspondence from him. But first, let's just consider a couple of emails. The first is from James Bowen, who will be joining us tonight on the Yada Yada radio program. He said, I try to explain it this way to someone who thought that exposing conspiracy theories was the equivalent to exposing religious lies and corruptions. And he wrote, let's say, for the sake of argument, that one in a million people who listen to the show or talk with one of us will come to accept that religions are errant and they'll come to know the truth. And let's say that one in a million people who read a conspiracy blog or talk to a conspiracy theorist will come to believe those theories. So why do one and not the other? The answer is simple. Because the person who comes to recognize the religious corruptions and knows the truth can do something about it. They can come to know Yah. And they can embrace the covenant. Whereas the one who comes to embrace the conspiracy theory can do nothing about it, other than try to convince others who can do nothing about it. That's why even if the theories were true, and they're not, it is an utter waste of time, in fact counterproductive, to convince anyone about them. Time can be much better spent elsewhere. And he wrote, what's funny is that even outside of those who know Yahweh's prophetic timeline, most conspiracy theorists acknowledge that there is nothing that they can do to stop the conspirators. Pushers like Alex Jones, who shares the network that we're recording on at this moment, and his kind don't even attempt answers or plans of actions other than doomsday prepping, which really isn't a solution. And by the way, they're also involved in the products they're hawking. Yeah. So why obsess over something that knowing, even if it were true, doesn't help you at all?
Yeah.
Our friend Jackie will also join us this evening. Said that this Larry fellow called this morning. He says, I'm expecting company in a few minutes. So I answered him and said, you know, I've got to keep the conversation short. So he was agitated because we told him he couldn't be on any of our shows anymore so long as he continued to promote conspiracy. And he said that people are defriending him. That means he's losing his audience on his Facebook page on Popular Truth. And that's the thing that scares him the most. He is certain that we're going to have another person, D, on the program this evening. Is involved in some way, but he is most angry and blames Lisa, whose letter we're going to read today as well, this evening. Then Larry started in on conspiracy theories. The one thing we said, you know, if you just stop doing, you're welcome back. Now, that would have been a mistake, as we know now. But nonetheless, what did he do? Rather than saying, you know, I was wrong on these conspiracy theories. No, he started right in them. He says, we all know that. And then he mentioned two of the wildest conspiracies. He says, I interrupted him to say that, you know, we do not agree on these conspiracy theories. And you should not be associated with them because of what Yahweh has to say about them. I was about to say, especially considering Yahweh's warning in Yeshayah Isaiah. Mm-hmm. But he says, but I was interrupted. Larry raised his voice, saying that he had to hang up. He didn't have time to talk. He had business calls. Then he collected himself for a moment. He says, you know, I'm not going to hang up. And instead, he returned to the subject of conspiracy and started to promote them all over again, saying that you are denial. You're in denial over not accepting these conspiracies. We all know that they're true.
That's what they use in college professors. Everyone knows that this is true.
Yes. Yeah. All scientists say.
Yeah, all scientists say. We're all agreed that.
We're all agreed that. The moment
the
you
food,
yeah.
Only a fool would disagree with this comment.
Yeah. Yeah. David, my good friend from the other side of the planet, he says, I was invited 2 years ago by Dee, I believe, to join and participate in Unpopular Truth, the fake book site. It was indeed a blending of Yahweh's words against a backdrop of conspiracies. I have spent little time there because of the tenor of the exchanges that were often vindictive and offensive. Like you, I was taken in by Larry's statements and his notes and his larger-than-life brash manner. I considered him a man's man who suffers fools badly. I am saddened by the revelations that that was not the case. I'm not surprised, however. Larry's comments are sickening, and as Roy noted, not unlike Dode in his latter days or like Shaul Paul. Says, I've not had an exchange with Larry since you ceased associations with him a while back. I'm in agreement, yet saddened by your decision to distance yourself from Larry. However, I realize it is the only step we can take to protect the Covenant family. Your latest draft letter, which we'll read tonight, to the Covenant family is well written. I wouldn't change a word of it. Now, I would like to say that what is the definition of a conspiracy? The legal definition is an agreement between two or more parties to engage jointly in an unlawful or criminal act, or an act that is innocent in and of itself, but becomes unlawful when it is done by the combination of the actors.
Yes.
A couple of more letters before we dive into some of this. It says, I'll be honest, I always listen to your shows via, this is from Brad, a longtime friend of mine and somebody that's become someone you communicate with fairly
yes,
regularly.
Indeed.
I'll be honest, I always listen to your shows via podcasts. Even going back a few years, I'd skip over the parts of your shows when Larry was a guest. I found him argumentative and condescending. I've never enjoyed arrogant people. I remember him calling the LAX TSA agent killing and Sandy Hook incidents a conspiracy. I disagreed. And he jumped all over me on Facebook. I didn't dislike him at all. In fact, I chose to love him, but I don't enjoy what he had to say. The only conspiracies I wonder about were the 9/11 plane that hit the Pentagon and childhood vaccines. I wondered, but I never saw the dots that connected these things. We're going to talk about both of those things today. Keep going and doing what you're doing. I really enjoy learning. I wish I could read faster. Thanks for your notes that you sent to me on the Torahless one not too long ago. James wrote, Larry's reasoning is the same that I see from all conspiracy theorists. We know X is evil and we did Y, therefore Z is true. No. We all know. And then, No, these things are not related. You cannot draw a conclusion from these unrelated things. Governments can't be trusted and have done evil, therefore every evil that occurs is caused by government. Every conspiracy theory there has ever talked to will start off with something that is completely valid and provable and then quickly descend into madness. The manipulation of the economy through fiat currency, which is true, and then how the Holocaust was faked. The Gulf of Tonkin, and then which is true, that it was made up as justification for the Vietnam War, and then reptilian angel or aliens infiltrating governments of the world. They say, as Larry does, that they can prove it all, but their proof is never more than speculation. How do you explain the World Trade Center 7? We're going to explain that. No planes in it. I will tell you exactly what happened to it. I don't know if we'll get time today, but if not today, the next observation show. Okay. Well, this is exactly what happened, and there is the evidence that it happened this way, so you just have to believe the lies you read. We'll cover those things.
Okay.
Now, before we go to this letter that I addressed regarding Larry, I wanted to just to dive in because we're running out of time today. I think this will be interesting. These are some of the most recent posts on Popular Truth. A fellow named Peter O'Connell posted a picture of this sheep with a bucket over its head. It was in a field with converging condensation trails, some, you know, most of which are intersection, the same altitude, about 35,000 feet, with a statement that says, oh, looks normal to me. So the sheep with a bucket over its head, and all of these intersecting contrails at about 30,000, 35,000 feet, and the sheep is saying, looks normal to me. Larry Hendricks writes, so says Craig Wynn. And then Robin Ball on that site says, with emoticons showing a person whose head was upside down, and one who was tilted to the side, and the like. And Larry says, good translator, but an idiot. All wrapped into one, that Craig is. He says, his translations are great, but he's just a dork on a personal level. Well, likable dork. Robin Ball says, his work is wonderful, yet his opinions and actions over conspiracies causes him to lose the precious respect, credibility, and audience he speaks about. My opposition to conspiracies and these groups caused them to lose credibility. Yeah, amongst them, that would be true. Larry Hendricks, yeah, I told him as much. So let's just start with condensation trails, since that's the first one here. Larry has been bragging all about concentration or condensation trails. He calls them, say they're chemtrails to him, but he says the alternative is a comtrail. I don't know if he just can't spell, or he doesn't know that COM in aviation is short for communications. But they are contrails in reality for condensation trails, and there is no such thing as a chemtrail, although that is the conspiracy. So let's just talk about
that. Let me just ask you real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there any way that someone who wanted to do something that way, that would that be a very... Is there any way that could be a viable delivery?
Have you ever seen somebody at 35,000 feet breathing the air in the midst of a contrail? No. Have you ever seen a contrail come from 35,000 feet down to the ground?
No, sir.
No.
And I live by five airports and three military and one.
I'm going to explain condensation trail. Mm-hmm. Cool air can't hold as much water vapor as warm air. So some of the vapor condenses onto tiny pieces of dust that are floating around in the air and forms tiny droplets around each dust particle. When billions of these droplets come together, they become a cloud. Clouds are made up of water droplets or ice crystals, which is just frozen water droplets that are so small and light they're able to stay in the air. But how does the water and ice that makes up these clouds get into the sky? And why are there different types of clouds formed? Because, you know, a condensation trail is nothing different than a cloud. It is a cloud. It's a linear cloud that happens to come out of a jet engine. Clouds are made up of these water droplets. I said the water or ice that make up clouds travels into the sky within the air as water vapor. Gas, water, you know, which is gas is another form of water. You know, just water vapor is a gas. It's a gaseous form of water. Water vapor gets into the air mainly through evaporation of some liquid water source, like oceans, lakes, rivers, primarily the ocean. And it travels up into the air. Warm air rises. Warm air is nearest the ground. It rises up. Particularly when the sun is shining, that's what causes the evaporation, causes the air to warm, that's what causes it to rise. When air rises in the atmosphere, it gets cooler, and it's under less pressure. When air cools, it is not able to hold all of the water vapor it once could. Air also can't hold as much water when the pressure drops. The pressure is substantially different at altitude than it is at the surface of the Earth. Substantially different. It's just like the pressure at the bottom of the ocean is substantially different than it is at the surface of the ocean.
Exactly.
Yeah. The vapor becomes small water droplets or ice crystals, and a cloud is formed. Even in the everyday atmosphere, if air is cooled enough as it rises, water molecules slow down. Temperature is a measure of the speed of molecules. It slows down as it gets colder. And when it slows down, these water, tiny particles of water, condense to form fog or clouds. The average temperature at 35,000 feet, average, that's the average altitude that a jet flies, is minus 54 C, minus 66 Fahrenheit. That's pretty cold, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty cold.
All right. At the surface, the average temperature is around 20 C, which is 68 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, at 20 C, you know, average day, the saturation pressure for water is 2,337. And the humidity ratio at saturation is 0.015. At minus 40 C, now, I'm telling you that jets fly at 35,000 feet where the average temperature is minus 54 C. But at minus 40 C, which is as low as this chart went that I used this morning to prepare, the saturation pressure is 13 versus 2,337. The difference is 183 times, or 18,300%. Less. And the humidity ratio at saturation is 0.00008. That's a difference of 188 times, or 18,800%. Now, let's talk about combustion, so you know where the water came from that is now being transformed into clouds. The water manifests itself in the cloud form because of the fact the air is minus 54 degrees Celsius, and the pressures are much lower. I'm going to use gasoline because kerosene is a much more complicated and varied material for combustion. Jets run on kerosene, which is called Jet A. But kerosene is very similar to gas. It's just a more complicated formula. So I'm going to use gasoline. And because, by the way, jet engines will also run on gasoline. This is the goes into the combustion process. 2C8, H18, plus 25O2. When combusted equates to 16CO2. You know what CO2 was? Carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm. Carbon.
So it results in, 2, C is carbon, 2C8, H18, H is hydrogen, plus 25O2, which is oxygen. When combusted, results in 16 CO2, carbon dioxide, plus 18 H2O. What's H2O?
Water.
Huh, son of a gun. So out of this combustion of 2C8, H18, plus 25O2, you get 16 carbon dioxide and 18 water. It's water that's coming out of the exhaust of a jet airplane, along with a little bit of, there's almost an equal amount of carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens with water Is it low pressure and low temperature?
It starts to drop.
It creates a cloud.
Yeah,
well, that's why it's got cards of cloud. That's what's called a condensation. It condenses. It forms a cloud. That is the answer. It isn't any more complicated than that. When you see a condensation trail, it is the result of water coming out of the exhaust of the jet engine into extremely cold air at low pressure, and it forms a cloud. There is nothing more to it than that. Now, let's go a little bit further here, though. Now, let's just pretend that these nutcases are right, that it's really not the result of combustion and the nature of water in a low-pressure, low-temperature environment, that the government really is trying to add biopoisons via their chemtrails. I would ask you this. What happens to the pathogens in water when you boil it?
It kills them.
What is the temperature in degrees Celsius of boiling?
100 degrees.
Do you know what the temperature is of the internal turbine in a jet engine?
Pretty darn hot.
800 Celsius.
Mm-hmm. Could kill it.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so.
Now, as for chemicals being distributed via chemtrails, when chemicals are exposed to temperatures over 800 degrees Celsius, 98% become unrecognizable in less than 1 second, degrading to the point of complete decomposition. You can't process a chemical through an environment that's 800 degrees C and have it come out as anything that's recognizable or useful. It is impossible.
It allows the
system,
right?
Now, beyond the fact that there's an easy explanation, and it's the same explanation for the clouds that you see in the sky every day, for condensation trails, and the fact that it's impossible to poison anybody through them, let's just ask some questions here. Why would the government do something that they're trying to keep secret and something is visible as a condensation trail? Why would you try to poison people at 35,000 feet?
No, that's a...
Why would they do it during the day?
What? How many people have you seen at 35,000 feet? Why spray toxins in the air with less than 0.00000001, one part in a trillion, actually reaching its intended target? Have you ever seen a contrail fall to the ground? Now, by the way, it is possible to have a condensation trail under very certain particular circumstances right at sea level. You can sometimes you see them in the military pictures they like to show, and you'll see the condensation trail coming out the back of a jet engine. And the reason for that, they're shooting that on an extremely cold day. And the jet engine, military jet engine, particularly in the afterburner, is extremely hot. And so it's pouring an enormous amount of exhaust out, and that exhaust is mostly water. And so it's possible to even have a condensation trail on an extremely cold day under perfect circumstances, but all the rest of them are up there at 35,000 feet. If you wanted to poison people, why wouldn't you put your poison in the water supply? Now, this is the concluding comment. When there's a readily available, obvious, rational, unchallenged, credible, easily verifiable explanation for something we see, why would anyone in their right mind ignore that and promote something as preposterous as chemtrails?
I was just wrapping up another show I was working on, but did you try the, well, we all know.
Have you guys
tried that one? We did.
Everybody knows.
We all know.
We are smart, aren't we?
Yes. We all know that we can see a condensation trail. Therefore, we are going to label it a chemtrail and decide that the same process that creates clouds, water vapor condensing in low pressure, low temperature environments, is now somehow a chemtrail. It's not water. No, it's chemicals. And that those chemicals, which we have demonstrated, cannot come through the back of a jet engine. It can't be processed through the fuel and come out the back of the jet engine. It's impossible. It's just impossible. And then, so someone will say, oh, no, that's not the way they do it. What they do is it's a separate tank for the chemicals, and they're put in the airplane, and then they're sprayed at the rear of the engine. You know what the exhaust temperature is of a jet engine? 800 degrees Celsius. It doesn't have a chance to cool down in the tiny, tiny fraction of a second that it gets from the hot section to the exhaust. It would still be destroyed. And by the way, do you want someone to believe that every jet airplane manufacturer has a separate tank that no one's ever seen, except those who fill them, at every FBO around the country, to hold a chemical? And that there's a special nozzle that those of us who have learned everything we can know about a jet engine, because it's really important, I fly a turboprop, that's a jet engine with a propeller on the front. Every component of that engine, we're required to know to be certified to fly that airplane.
Well, doesn't your son work on airplanes, too?
My son has great stories about chemtrails. Because engineers and scientists think that anybody that promotes the notion of a chemtrail is an absolute, utter moron. And they say they don't even want to be on the same planet that they're on. So my son will go up in the flying test bed for General Electric to test, you know, one of his new engines. And there's the pilots of those jets know exactly the altitude, therefore pressure, and temperature, which is also related to the lapse rate in the atmosphere. They know exactly when the condensation trail will form out of the engines. Because it won't form, you know, if it's really warm, or there's high pressure, it will form when the pressure is low and the temperatures are low. And they will say, okay, I want everybody to look. We're about ready to release the chemtrails. And they'll just laugh, and everybody will have a hoot. They make fun of it. They mock it. By the way, I do too. You know, and if you are stupid enough to promote chemtrails, Larry does and his minions on Unpopular Truth, it's because you haven't bothered to consider the facts, and because you're spending all of your time ignoring 99% of the evidence on a 1% that has been twisted by somebody who is beguiling you.
I've sent you a message on this. How can people, obviously these people have started, they find the path. And they're going down the path, they know that part of it. And something about them brought them to that. How do they not apply that same thing to the other stuff that they look at?
That's what I'm. By the way, I'm hoping they don't. I have read now 50 pages of posts by some of the most inane, rude, and irrational people I've ever encountered at Unpopular Truth, and I am hoping that the deprivation of a functioning conscience and the ability to process information rationally that has led them to promote these absurd conspiracy theories has also made it impossible for them to evaluate Yahweh's testimony credibly. Because if they have come to understand who Yahweh is and what is required to be in the covenant based upon what I have written, based upon what these people have said, I owe God an enormous apology.
Well,
so I am hoping for my relationship with God that there is an aim on understanding who He is as they are on promoting these theories, because they are really nasty people. And I don't want anything to do with them, and I know God doesn't either.
Well, and that's like I told you, one of the things is that we are told to walk away and rely upon Yah. And when I just feel like when people do this, it's okay to tell people that, hey, over here, that's a poisonous snake. This is something that you don't want to be around. It's dangerous. That's fine. But if all you do is spend all your time telling me about the dangerous snake, What are we doing? Obviously, you told me. I listened to your warning.
Right.
I'm moving on. I don't need to keep hearing about it.
You know, if you know,
and it is.
Yahweh himself says, "Do not speak of conspiracies. Don't do it." Now, I didn't know if I had known that God said that back in the time that I devoted all the time to trying to create the unification theory, both in political and religious stories. I would never have done it. But once a friend of mine sent me, said, you know, you really ought to consider the 8th chapter of Yahshua Isaiah. And so I translated and says, God unequivocally says that if you promote, if you articulate, doesn't say participate in, if you speak about conspiracies, you're going to be separated from me, that you're going to become delusional and you'll be paranoid.
Which is 100% correct. How are you relying on him if all you're worried about is what they're doing?
Right. Why would you continue to pursue that which has no value and is, of course, stupid when God tells you don't do it? Now, it's impossible, in my view, for any of them to have a relationship with Yahweh if they're willing to ignore his testimony in this regard and continue to be belligerent on their conspiracies. Let me read another post. This is from another one of those people that I really hope does not have the... I hope that the same ignorance that she shows regarding conspiracies, she is showing to Yahweh's testimony, because I would really be uncomfortable if I was responsible for this person somehow ending up in the covenant, because God would not be pleased with me. I would bear a lot of shame for this. Her name is Carol Verduzco, V-E-R-D-U-Z-C-O. They can say whatever they want to, but they ain't just conspiracy theories. They are legit and corroborated. Not corroborated. Corroborated. These people can't write either. With a great deal of evidence, like vaccines do harm, they maim and they kill. We'll talk about that today or on an upcoming show. The Twin Towers was an inside job. Chemtrails are real. IDGAF, whatever the heck that means. What Craig says, he can kiss my enriched white ass. Exclamation.
It means I don't give a...
Oh, I don't give a flying leap.
Yeah.
I don't give a, you know, I'm actually pleased that I don't know what the slang means that these people are using. I would say that's a,
in my defense, I am younger than you.
Yes, you are. I don't give a flying leap. Okay. And, so she doesn't give a F what I say, and yet she's in a group that claims that their primary purpose is to share Yahweh's testimony. How did they know him? Apart from what I have written. In my opinion, he's been bought. Yeah, I did, but you didn't know that. I've been bought. I've been bought by the anti-conspiracy crowd.
It's been a hell of a kick. Huh?
Yeah, I tell you what, I've been bought. And now he's drinking the Kool-Aid. You know, when people are in religion, they always, and politics, they do the same thing. The mother's milk of religion and politics. They project their own failings on anybody who is opposing them. Well, that's what she's doing here. Now, he's drinking the Kool-Aid. She's drinking the Kool-Aid. And obviously, most of the covenant has no backbone. That's why, you know, they claim to be part of the covenant. They wouldn't even use the term covenant as being something you could belong to if it wasn't for what I've written. No one used the covenant as something you could belong to. Part of the books that I've written.
Right.
Wouldn't have a clue.
Not the terminology anyway.
She says, I have no backbone, and I just rolled over. And I'm not going to roll over to go along with his BS. Screw that! ! Not this girl. No way, no how. I have a mind of my own. It's too bad. You're incapable of using it. Frank Urban wrote, as long as I can remember is what he meant to say. All truth does not save. She said, I seek all truth. And he said, no, all truth does not save your soul. Only very specific truth does. Rick Bryant said, show some proof, girl. Well, you're bad-mouthing Craig and his well-researched reasons to call it a pile of crap. Kiss your own behind, since you're obviously so sure of yourself. Don't be a jerk and start judging Craig unless you can prove and not just parrot the hearsay from questionable sources.
Good
Frank,
response.
Yeah, that's a good response. Frank says, we really don't need to fight here. Craig is obviously really smart. He's done his homework. He just doesn't want these things presented because he doesn't want to muddy the water. Well, that's far more than that, Frank.
Yeah.
Whether true or not, no, it matters whether true or not, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
This is my point, and I'm convinced that it is also his. No, it's not just that they aren't true. It's that they destroy your credibility. When you promote, when you say chemtrails are real, then, or that the Twin Towers was an inside job. You're an idiot. You're just flat out an idiot. And you've destroyed whatever credibility you would otherwise have. And when you combine that, as Carol did, with a mention of the covenant, you're destroying the value of this message for anybody that's rational.
You also have to be right. With what we're doing with this, you have to be right almost 100% of the time. If you are wrong ever, you're going to lose credibility with people. And like you just said, if you're talking about something and I can prove you wrong, nobody's going to believe you on any of this. You can be right 9 out of 10 times. Everybody's only going to remember that 10th time.
Well, the difference is Craig can be corrected. Once he sees that I was wrong, he'll write it out.
That happens all the time. When you ask that, don't promote conspiracies, I stop promoting conspiracies.
You're going to make mistakes. That's not
right.
But you learn from it and then move on to the truth.
Making a mistake is one thing. To start promoting it and having that be, without a lack of a better word, doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
They act like this is doctrine.
Yeah,
they follow
it's
the every, well, everybody knows.
Yeah.
Everybody knows.
Carol Verduzco said, kiss my ass, Rick. And anyone who has a problem with me, my opinions are my own, and I don't give two flying hoots about you. I shouldn't say flying hoots, or yours. Keep drinking the Kool-Aid. I won't waste my time deliberating with someone so close-minded. See, 100% of what they do is project their failings on others. Keep sucking down the fluoride and popping the vaccines. It doesn't matter to me. We're going to talk about fluoride and vaccines in a moment. And she says, same to you, classless female dog. I didn't use the term female dog. Also, this is now Shannon Graham. I'd put Shannon Graham in the same class I would Carol Verduzco, in the same class that I would put Larry Hendricks. Also, I can say it is a conspiracy, she put all caps, conspiracy, against Larry Hendricks, because no one has showed me any proof, capital proof, yet. So how is what is going on with Larry any different? We're going to talk about old Larry tonight.
Well, what about
you can rest assured that we're going to talk about old Larry tonight. You want proof? You don't deserve it. You couldn't process it if it was given to you on a silver platter. But for the rest of the people that are rational and are trying to figure this out, we're going to provide the proof this evening. Now, shouldn't his accusers, who are accusing him publicly, all in caps again, also show the all in caps evidence so that we can examine it as fake news, all in capitals, or facts? I will consider everything they're saying about Larry fake news, Shannon says. Shannon says, I read the actual scriptures minus D's conspiracies, and there's nothing in Yah's words that say don't expose lies. What does speak of the false deities? She's just clueless here. I've read all of this about the church and false religions against him. Advancing those things are conspiracies that hurt people and keep people from Yahweh. Do you think that old Shannon here would have any idea that God's name is pronounced Yahweh if she hadn't read my book.
I've never seen it anywhere else.
No. Why don't you all see that, she screams.
To be fair, I wouldn't know that either.
Yeah.
I wouldn't. I remember the first day that we met.
We went through that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I went through a week. I devoted a week of my life to saying, you know, I'm going to do my best to try to understand how to pronounce these three letters, there's four letters of name, but two are repeated. I looked at every single word in the Hebrew lexicon and how those letters were pronounced. And I wrote page after page after page showing the research and then showing the names and showing the words that are most prevalent today that convey the proper pronunciation, like Torah, for example, the A-H, Torah, it comes from the H at the end of it. It's a vowel.
Mm-hmm.
It's two of them in Yahweh's name. It's Torah. And then I looked at probably the most commonly repeated Hebrew word is shalom. The O in shalom comes from the Hebrew wa. It also is a vowel. That's how to pronounce all the letters except the first letter, which no one disputes, which is the yod.
Wow, yeah.
It's the Y. Pronounced the same way in English as it is in Hebrew. Therefore, it is Yahweh. It is based on the verb haya by God's own definition. Haya, which tells you how to pronounce two of the letters, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
First syllable in Yahweh's name.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh. And I went through everything to explain this is the totality of the evidence that is presented to us on the pronunciation of his name in his own testimony, and he ought to know. But you wouldn't know it anyplace else. There is no other place that pronunciation can be derived. Then this person says, for the love of Yah, this is Shannon Graham again, can someone please show me the gathered evidence you say you have against Larry, and that will shut my mouth up fast. No, it won't. I'm going to show it to you tonight. We're going to spend 3 or 4 hours on it tonight. It won't shut you up. As a woman and sister, why can't I see it? I want to know who the wolves are, but I can't blindly make assumptions without evidence. I did not come to Yahweh based upon a man's words. Oh, yeah, you did. You came to him based upon my translations, if you came to him at all. I saw evidence first. Where'd you see the evidence? It wasn't in my books. And these people are irrational.
Yeah.
No one shows me the alleged evidence against our brother Larry, and I'm deleted. I don't know what that means.
I don't either.
I will know.
I'm guessing she was deleted from as a friend or from a group.
Okay.
You're wiped out.
Okay.
Or something.
And then I will know it was all fake and unfortunate conspiracy against Larry. I'm a very decent investigator, says this woman who's been promoting the chemtrails. People come to me to find shit out. She spells shit with a Y. And I do. I work for attorneys, for goodness sake. Can you imagine having this woman work in a law office? I mean, I'm just flabbergasted. I examine all evidence is in caps before I conclude. That is, and she still promotes chemtrails. Yeah, right. That is fair and right thing to do. It is wisdom. I do not believe someone without evidence. It is foolish, all caps, to take someone's word without evidence. Even Yahweh wants us to question him and examine the evidence. So none of us are exempt from that either. So in the words of that ridiculous, she can't spell it. She spells it with an E. Commercial of late. Where's the beef? It's not of late. It's of a long time ago. Where's the beef? Show me what you have on me. Please. Thank you kindly. Then Chad Young writes, who gets to define conspiracy? Now, the world has no problem defining conspiracy. You go to any site that says, you know, what are the most popular conspiracies? It's the same ones all the time. It's exactly the same ones. I mean, the most popular ones recently could be categorized under fake news, like the Pizzagate one and the false flags of Sandy Hook and the Pulse nightclub and the Boston Marathon. Those would all be under fake news. But the conspiracies, you go to any site, they've got the same 15 or 20 of them. So it's not hard to define. And then he says, take the World Trade Towers. I'm not allowed to look at the fact that they are the only steel towers to have ever collapsed from a fire. I'm not allowed to say Building 7 didn't even get hit by a plane and still collapsed at free fall speed? Not to question these things is crazy. When a group of people tell you what to think and not to think, excommunication is the result. That is the definition of a cult. I don't think there's anything as cultish as these people who gather together to promote their conspiracy theories. Shannon, the great thinker, says, thank you, all in caps! Exclamation, exclamation, exclamation.
Well, to be fair, Craig, we don't know how hot the chemtrail chemicals are. I mean, it could really melt steel, I mean.
You know, if the combustion in a jet engine could melt the titanium in the hot section of the engine, then every airplane would fall out of the sky. Now, I'm going to talk to you about the Twin Towers. It's not hard to figure out, but I want to do this. I think it's important that we lay this to rest.
Please.
The Twin Towers were designed and built in the mid-1960s. By the way, I've been in them. I've been to the top floor. I've actually given a presentation to a business in the Twin Towers. In fact, I was a co-sponsor of an event along with Fred Smith, the founder of Federal Express. So I've been there, very top of the Twin Towers. They were designed in the mid-1960s through the early 1970s. They represented a new approach to skyscrapers, and that they were very lightweight and involved modular construction methods in order to accelerate the schedule and to reduce the costs. Each tower was 64 square meters, standing 411 meters. That's a little over 3 feet for those that are impaired in terms of measuring units, above street level and 21 meters below grade. This produces a height-to-width ratio of 6.8 times. The total weight of the structure is roughly 500,000 tons. But the wind load, rather than gravity load, dominates the design. The building is a huge sail that must resist a 225 kilometer per hour hurricane. It was designed to resist a wind load of 2 kPa, a total of lateral load of 5,000 tons. All right, the buildings were designed to resist the one element that they thought they would have to resist, wind.
Mm-hmm.
In order to make each tower capable of withstanding this wind load, the architect selected a lightweight perimeter tube design consisting of 244 exterior columns of 36 centimeter square steel box sections on 100 centimeter centers. That means they're 100 centimeters centers apart, and they're 36 centimeters square box steel. And there's 244 of them that that form the skeleton, the external part of the Twin Towers. Inside this outer tube, if you will, it's a tube now when it's got the glass and the external panels on it. It's, you know, it's just a bunch of tall perimeter,
frame.
Otherwise, inside the outer tube there was a 27 meter times 40 meter core, which was designed to support the weight of the tower. It was also housed the elevators, the stairwells, and the mechanical risers and utilities. Web joists, 80 centimeters tall, connected the core to the perimeter of each story. Concrete slabs were poured over these joists to form the floors. In essence, the building is an egg crate that is about 95% air, explaining why the rubble after the collapse was only a few stories high.
This doesn't really...
You know, prior to the World Trade Center with its lightweight perimeter tube design, most tall buildings contained columns on 5-meter centers and contained massive amounts of masonry carrying some of the structural load. The World Trade Center was primarily a lightweight steel structure. However, its 244 perimeter columns made it one of the most redundant and one of the most resilient skyscrapers ever built. The early news reports noted how well the towers withstood the initial impact of the aircraft. And they didn't topple over when the aircraft hit them. However, when one recognizes that the buildings had more than 1,000 times the mass of the aircraft and had been designed to resist steady wind loads of 30 times the weight of the aircraft, this ability to withstand the initial impact is hardly surprising. Furthermore, there was no significant wind on September 11th. The outer perimeter columns were only stressed before the impact to about one-third of their 200 MPa designed allowable. The only individual metal component of the aircraft that is capable in or comparable in strength to the box perimeter columns of the World Trade Center is the keel beam at the bottom of the aircraft fuselage. While the aircraft impact undoubtedly destroyed several columns in the World Trade Center, the wing spars are also pretty stout, but they're no match for the steel. But at that speed, you know, the wing spars would have taken out columns as well. He didn't write that, but that's just something I thought I'd throw in for you. No extra cost. The number of columns lost on the initial impact was not large, however, and the loads were shifted to the remaining columns in this highly redundant structure. Of equal or even greater significance during this initial impact was the explosion when 90,000 liquid gallons of jet fuel, 90,000 liquid gallons of Jet A kerosene, comprising nearly one-third of the aircraft's weight, ignited. The ensuing fire was clearly the principal cause of the collapse. The fire is the most misunderstood part of the World Trade Center collapse. Even today, the media report and many scientists believe that the steel melted. Oh, goodness. It is argued that the jet fuel burns very hot, especially with so much fuel present.
I've been to Birmingham and the steel mills.
That's not true. Yes. That is correct. Okay. Yeah, otherwise, we'll read on.
Okay.
And I'll tell you who wrote this and where this was published when we get to the end of it. The temperature is defined as an intensive property, meaning that it does not vary with the quantity of material, while the heat is an extensive property, which does not vary with the amount of material. Oh, that's important to understand. I know it's a little complicated, but if you're going to want to go and promote these myths, you ought to be able to process what is, I think, fairly plain English in a description of them, of what actually happened. Now, one is a way to distinguish the one way to distinguish the two is to note that if a second log, for example, is added to a fireplace, the temperature does not double. It stays roughly the same. But the size of the fire and the length of the time the fire burns, or a combination of the two, doubles. Thus, the fact is wood burns at the same temperature. It's just that you're now adding more wood. It's going to either burn longer, or it's going to be the size of the fire or the length of the time that it's going to burn are going to increase. But that's it. The temperature doesn't go up. Thus, the fact that there were 90,000 liquid liters, this says here, of jet fuel on a few floors of the World Trade Center does not mean that this was an unusually hot fire. The temperature of the fire at the World Trade Center was not unusual, and it was most definitely not capable of melting steel. In a diffuse flame, this is what happens. You know, there's lots of ways you can create a flame. For example, you can add pure oxygen to a combustible material like kerosene. You can get a flame at 33,000 C, for example, under the perfect circumstances, the perfect mix of oxygen, pure oxygen, and fuel. But this was a diffuse fire, which means that the fuel and the oxidizer, the oxygen, were not mixed before ignition, but flowed together in an uncontrolled manner, and then combusted when the fuel-oxygen ratios reached the values within the flammable range. A fireplace flame is a diffuse flame burning in air, as was the World Trade Center fire. If the fuel and the oxidants start at ambient temperature, a maximum flame temperature can be defined. For carbon, burning in pure oxygen. Now, I went through the makeup of gasoline. It's a carbon-based fuel, so is kerosene. For a carbon burning in pure oxygen, the maximum temperature is 3,200 degrees Celsius. For hydrogen, it is 2,750. Remember, those were the components that went into the jet engine from the fuel. Thus, for virtually any hydrocarbon, the maximum flame temperature starting at ambient temperature using pure oxygen in the absolute perfect conditions in the perfect mix is 3,000 degrees Celsius. This maximum flame temperature is reduced by two-thirds if air is used instead of pure oxygen. The maximum flame temperature increases for burning hydrocarbons, the jet fuel, in air is thus about 1,000 degrees C. That's hardly sufficient to melt steel, which melts at 1,500 degrees C. But it is very difficult to reach this maximum temperature of 1,000 degrees C with a diffuse flame. There is nothing to ensure that the fuel and the air in a diffuse flame are mixed in an ideal ratio. Therefore, diffuse flames are fuel-rich, meaning that excess fuel molecules, which are unburned, must also be heated. It is known that most diffuse fires are fuel-rich because blowing on a campfire, for example, what happens when you blow on a campfire? It causes the flame to rise, right? Because you're adding now more oxygen to it. What happens on a blacksmith bellow on the fire is when he bellows more air into the fire.
It blows, it makes it
right.
Bigger.
Right. So you solve the problem of fuel-rich fires by deliberately adding more air, which, you know, has, 21% oxygen. This fuel-rich diffuse flame can drop the temperature by a factor of two again. This is why the temperatures in a residential home fire are usually in the 500 C to 650 degrees C range. It is known that the World Trade Center fire was fuel-rich, a diffuse flame, as evidenced by the copious amounts of black smoke. Soot is generated by incompletely burned fuel. Hence, the World Trade Center fire was fuel-rich. Hardly surprising with 90,000 liters of jet fuel. It is highly unlikely that the steel of the World Trade Center experiences temperatures above 750 to 800 degrees Celsius. That's still really hot.
Here we are.
But it's half the temperature required to melt steel. It is known that structural steel begins to soften, however, at 425 degrees Celsius. That's half the temperature that the fire burned. And loses about half of its strength at 650 degrees Celsius. This is why steel is stress relieved in this temperature range. But even a 50% loss of strength is still insufficient by itself to explain the World Trade Center collapse. It was noted above that the wind load controlled the design allowables. The World Trade Center, on this low wind day, was likely not stressed more than a third of the design allowable, which was roughly one-fifth of the yield strength on the steel. Even with its strength halved by the temperature, exposure to this temperature, the steel could still support two to three times the stress imposed by a 650 degree Celsius fire. The additional problem was distortion of the steel in the fire. The temperature of the fire was not uniform everywhere. And the temperature on the outside of the box columns was clearly lower than on the side facing the fire. The temperature along the 18-meter-long joists was certainly not uniform. given the thermal expansion of steel at 150 degrees Celsius, the difference from one location to another will produce yield-level residual stress. This produced distortions in the slender structural steel, which resulted in buckling failures. Thus, the failure of the steel was due to two factors: loss of strength due to the temperature of the fire, but primarily loss of structural integrity due to the distortion of the steel from non-uniform temperatures in the fire. Nearly every large building has a redundant design that allows for loss of one or more structural member, such as a column. However, when multiple members fail, the shifting load eventually overstresses the adjacent members, and the collapse occurs like a row of dominoes falling down. The perimeter tube design of the World Trade Center was highly redundant. It survived the loss of several exterior columns due to the aircraft impact, but the ensuing fire led to other steel failures. Many structural engineers believe that the weak points, which were the limiting factors on all design allowables, were the angle clips that held the floor joists between the columns on the perimeter wall and the core structure. Remember, we talked about how you had that external core structure, and then inside you had the internal structure that held the weight, and all of the floor beams were connected between the two. They were held in place by angle clips. With a 700 PA floor design allowable, each floor should have been able to support approximately 1,300 tons beyond its own weight. The total weight of each tower was 500,000 tons. As the joists on one or two of the most heavily burned floors gave way, the outer box columns began to bow outward. The floors above them fell. The floor below, with its 1,300-ton design capacity, could not support the roughly 45,000 tons of 10 floors or more crashing down on it, on these angle clips in particular. This started the domino effect that caused the buildings to collapse within 10 seconds, hitting the bottom at an estimated speed of 200 kilometers per hour. If it had been free fall with no restraint, the collapse would only have taken 8 seconds and would have impacted at 300 kilometers per hour. It has been suggested that it was fortunate that the World Trade Center did not tip over into other buildings surrounding the area. There were several points that could be made. First, the building is not solid. It is 95% air and hence can implode onto itself. Second, there was no lateral load. Even the impact of the speeding aircraft, which is sufficient to move the center of gravity 100 feet onto the side, such that it was within the base footprint of the structure. So even the aircraft, which could move one of the, you know, some of those columns 100 feet towards the center of the building, that was still kept it within the core of the building itself. Third, given the free fall collapse, there was insufficient time for the portions to attain sufficient lateral velocity. To summarize all of these points, a 500,000-ton structure has too much inertia to fall in any direction other than straight down. Now, if you want the complete analysis of this, although I think I've shared you everything you need to know, on how the World Trade Center's towers collapsed, you can read The Role of Metallurgy in the NIST Investigation of the World Trade Center Towers Collapse. It is published in the December 2007 issue of the member journal of the Minerals, Metals, and Materials Society. That's who wrote this. That's where this came from. Is the member journal of the Minerals, Metals, and Materials Society. Now, the other thing he mentioned is Building 7, it wasn't hit. So how in the world can it have fallen? It had to be a government inside job. It was detonated by the U.S. government to cover up their complicity, they will say. Popular Mechanics, in August 20th of 2008, published the report from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. It was then that they released their long-awaited report on the collapse of the World Trade 7 following the attacks of September 11, 2001. Quote, our take-home message today is that the reason for the collapse of World Trade 7 is no longer a mystery. The NIST lead investigator, Shyam Sunder, told journalists at today's press conference in Gaithersburg, Maryland, quote, WT7 collapsed because of the fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosions or from diesel fuel fires. The Popular Mechanics article on this says, conspiracy theorists have long pointed to the collapse of the 47-story structure as the key evidence that the U.S. government orchestrated or abetted the 9/11 attacks. No planes struck that building, and the commonly available views of the exterior didn't show significant damage. Oh, by the way, that changed, and I'll share where that changed with you in a moment. Yet at 5:20 p.m., 7 hours after the collapse of the Twin Towers, WTC 1 and 2, WTC 7 rapidly fell in on itself. Since WT 7 housed Secret Service and CIA offices, conspiracy theorists claimed that the building was destroyed in a controlled demolition in order to obliterate evidence of the U.S. government's complicity in the terrorist attacks. Quote, it is impossible for a building to fall the way it fell without explosives being involved, stated actress and TV personality Rosie O'Donnell on ABC's debut on March 2007. Quote, for the first time in history, steel was melted by fire. It's physically impossible, end quote, she said.
Really?
Oh,
first time in history.
Wow. Yeah, I guess the conspiracy theorists have somebody they can cling to. This is what the article says. Popular Mechanics. Today's report confirms that a fire was indeed the cause. Sunder, who is the lead investigator, told reporters at a press conference, what we found was that an uncontrolled building fire, similar to the fires experienced in other tall buildings, caused an extraordinary event, the collapse of WTC 7. The unprecedented nature of the event means that understanding the precise mechanism of the collapse is important, not just to answer conspiracy theorist questions, but to improve safety standards in the engineering of large buildings. By the way, it does no good whatsoever to answer a conspiracy theorist question. They are as devout and as resistant to evidence and reason as is a religious person. I'm sharing this because there are people who are smart, who really do want to know the truth, that have been suckered in. And so I'm providing these explanations not for the promoters of conspiracy theories. You're lost. You're hopeless. Evidence and reason will not prevail with you. But there's lots of people who have been lured in by them. Now, the final report describes how debris from the collapse of WTC 1 ignited fires on at least 10 floors of WTC 7 at the western half of the south face. Fires on floors 7 through 9 and 11 through 13 burned out of control because the water supply to the automatic sprinkler system failed. The primary and backup water supply to the sprinkler systems for the lower floors failed as well because it relied on the city's water supply. those water lines were damaged by the collapse of WTC 1 and 2. Those uncontrolled fires in WTC 7 eventually spread to the northeast part of the building where the collapse began. After 7 hours of uncontrolled fires, a steel girder on floor 13 lost its connection to one of the 81 columns supporting the building. Floor 13 collapsed, creating a cascade of floor failures to floor 5. Column 79, no longer supported by a girder, buckled, triggering a rapid succession of structural failures that moved from east to west. All 23 central columns followed by the exterior columns. Failed in what is known as a progressive collapse, that is, local damage that spreads from one structural element to another, eventually resulting in the collapse of the entire structure. The report clarifies a number of widely debated issues concerning the collapse, particularly the role of the building's many diesel fuel tanks and the importance of structural damage from WTC-1 debris. Both of those factors have been cited by investigators as possibly contributing to the collapse. The 2006 Popular Mechanics book, Debunking 9/11 Myths, Why Conspiracy Theories Can't Stand Up to the Facts, that was back in 2006. I guess that was only 11 years ago, so we couldn't expect those still promoting these myths to have found that article, yes, mentions both hypotheses. However, final NIST report downplays both scenarios, concluding that the diesel fuel stored in the tanks and intended to power the backup generators did not burn long enough or hot enough to account for structural failures. And while the debris damage to WTC-7's southern exterior was considerable and initiated the destructive fires, the collapse originated in the northeast portion of the building. In fact, the report concludes, even without the structural damage, WTC would have collapsed from the fires alone. The report determines that the actual culprit was the collapse for the collapse was the combustion of ordinary building furnishings. These uncontrolled fires had characteristics similar to those that have occurred previously in tall buildings. If the sprinkler system in WTC-7 had been working, the fires in WTC-7 would have been controlled and the collapse would have been prevented. The report also suggests that the current engineering standards for coping with fire-induced thermal expansion need to be reexamined, particularly for buildings like WTC-7 that have long, unsupported floor spans. Because what? Of the unequal heating causes buckling. Sure. The key factor in the collapse, the NIST concluded, was the failure of structural connections that were designed to resist gravity loads but not thermally induced lateral loads. According to Sunder, for the first time, we have been shown that a fire can induce a progressive collapse. Spurned by conspiracy theory questions, and by the way, they're not asking questions, they're promoting their religion. Investigators did look specifically at the possibility that explosives may have been involved. Hypothetical blast events did not play a role in the collapse of WTC-7, the report states, adding that the investigators found absolutely no evidence or any residue for explosives. And that explanation required invocation of a blast event. Moreover, the smallest charge capable of initiating a column failure would have resulted in a sound level of 130 decibels to 140 decibels at a distance of at least a half a mile. Not only did witnesses not report hearing such a loud noise, none is audible on any of the recordings of the collapse.
Amazing.
That was in Popular Mechanics. The Daily Mail published a video. It says, its dramatic collapse several hours after the Twin Towers failed triggered a decade of conspiracy theories. Those who believe that the September 11 attacks on America were not carried out by Al-Qaeda terrorists, pointed to the fall of the World Trade Center Building 7 as proof of their wild claims. But a newly released video appears to finally prove, once and for all, that Building 7 was brought down by the intense heat of blazing World Trade Center and not explosives, as conspiracy theorists claim. The video shows up-close shots from the lower floors of the World Trade Center, Building 7, just across the street from the Twin Towers, and focuses on the exterior metal beams of Building 7 as they began to buckle as they were overheated. It's not just they were overheated, as they were unevenly heated, but the journalist did a nice job anyway.
Yes.
You can see the results in the video. The buckling led to floors falling one on another, causing the building to collapse.
Well, I hope they're not building buildings this way anymore.
Well, you know,
you think they should?
No. It's not the fault of the building. You don't build a lawnmower thinking that somebody's going to use it to prune a hedge.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay? You don't build a building thinking someone's going to be as stupid as an Islamic jihadist and going to fly planes into it. That would be really, you just don't, you,
well, you can't try
you,
it, yeah.
No, you, you no, you, no, and even if you could foresee an Islamic jihadist, flying a plane into a building, you wouldn't, you would be impossible to design for it. It's just like the myth on the vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
There is no such thing in medicine that is 100% effective, that only does good and never does any bad. There's never been any doctor, there's never been any treatment, there's never been any medicine, even going right down to aspirin, that has only produced a favorable result and has never produced a negative result. Do you know what percentage of vaccines cause a serious negative effect?
Under 5%?
Oh, no.
Under 1 would be my guess.
One in 83,000. The most prevalent serious effect of all vaccines is encephalitis, which is the swelling of the brain. One in 83,000. How many people do you think, and by the way, for people that are killed by a vaccine, and it can happen. It's not impossible. Bodies can be susceptible to things. I mean, there's lots of things that bodies can be susceptible to.
Well, the body's not very strong. Let's be completely fair. There's
right,
a lot of things
right.
that affect your body.
Right. One in every 2 million people die from a vaccine. So, yes. Is it possible to have a negative effect, a significant, yes, encephalitis, swelling of the brain, and dying? Oh, those are serious effects. One in 83,000 and one in 1 million.
2 million.
In 2 million. What do you think the number is? And that's the people that take vaccines. And by the way, there's no difference in the immune system of a child. As a matter of fact, sometimes a child has a much better immune system than does an adult.
Look at chickenpox.
Yeah.
You get them
okay.
as an adult, you're in trouble.
Now look at the vaccines that we have developed for things like chickenpox, for things like smallpox, for things like polio. How many people do you suppose have been precluded from death and crippling diseases because of the benefit of those vaccines?
Well, one of them was me.
There you go.
Most people in my generation all had them.
Yeah. So, I mean, the numbers are in the hundreds of millions.
Easily.
Now, there are those that will say, well, yeah, what about because one of these people says that the disorder that
autism.
There, that's one. Okay, so Shannon Graham, our brilliant contributor here, says, my son has autism after the shots. He wasn't born with it. That's my proof, she says. My son, having autism after the series of shots, wasn't born with it. That's my proof. All right. The widespread fear that vaccines increase the risk of autism originated in 1997 by a study published by Andrew Wakefield, a British surgeon. The study was published in Lancet, a prestigious medical journal, suggesting that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine was increasing autism in British children. The paper has since been completely discredited due to serious procedural errors, undisclosed financial conflicts of interest, and ethical violations. Andrew Wakefield lost his medical license, and the paper was retracted from Lancet. Nevertheless, the hypothesis was taken seriously, and others, major studies were conducted. None of them found any link between any vaccine and the likelihood of developing autism. Today, the true causes of autism remain a mystery. But to discredit the autism vaccine link theory, several studies have now tried to identify the symptoms of autism in children, as well as to receive those who receive the MMR vaccine. And more recent research provides evidence that autism develops in utero well before a baby is born or receives the vaccinations. Now, that's the truth. I mean, I don't know which one of these conspiracy theories, and, you know, when we return a week from now, we'll do, because I think it's Shannon again that wants to condemn fluoride in water. We'll cover that one, too. We're going to systematically go through them all, and then we're going to talk about how and why I don't like it when folks like Larry and Unpopular Truth intermix conspiracies and Yahweh's testimony. We'll talk about other things about Larry and Unpopular Truth tonight on the Yada Yah radio program. But, folks, I don't care what conspiracy theory it is. They're very easy to disprove. I mean, all of these now that are the modern-day conspiracy theories, every one of them is extraordinarily easy to disprove. In an hour's worth of time, you could take down the top 10 of them. The only way that they're promoted is like-minded people gathering together and all drinking from the same well, telling each other how wonderful they are and how everybody else in the world is crazy.